This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I think what we've found with these villages in Alaska is that there's not really a clear game plan, right? Like, if a community needs to move, how do you make that decision? Who's in charge? Who moves first? How do you pay for it? You know, there are all these, like, really clear questions that need to be answered. And I think that's what sort of the biggest takeaway here is that we need to figure out what that system is, because every community can't be on its own and trying to figure it out.
We've heard the warnings for years now. Climate change will someday force people to move from their homes. Sea level rise will put places from Miami to the Maldives underwater. For the remote Alaskan village of Shishmaref, that time has already arrived. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talk with environmental journalist Kate Shepherd of the Huffington Post. She tells us what goes into relocating an entire town that's being rendered unlivable by climate change, and what the experience of Shishmaref can teach us as our planet continues to warm. Then we lighten things up a bit in a brief discussion with ersatz Republican Congressman Jack Kimball, who represents California's mythical 54th Congressional District. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by senior environmental reporter from the Huffington Post, Kate Shepherd. Kate, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you back. You just penned a piece for the Huffington Post about a very small village in Alaska, Shishmaref, and what climate change is doing to this village. Why don't you give us the executive summary, if you will?
Sure. So Shishmaref is a village that it's this little tiny island that they live on. It's up off the coast of Alaska. It's in the Chukchi Sea. It's this little tiny spit of land, and it's been facing a lot of erosion issues because of climate change. They've had a lot of erosion there for a long time, but climate change has made it worse because there's the permafrost is melting, so the soil is less stable, and also there is less sea ice cover in the early part of the winter, so the land is vulnerable to storms for a much longer period of time. And seeing all of these effects happening, the town voted in 2002 to relocate and to move somewhere else where they could, you know, start the community over again and you know, have to deal with these erosion and climate issues. But, you know, after that vote, there are all these stories about all these Alaskan towns who decided to move and how they were going to move. And I went up to look because 12 years later, they still haven't moved. And I wanted to see sort of what was holding them back, why it was so hard to move this community.
Anybody who's read any history as a child will look at a situation and say, well, why don't they just get out of there? The plague or any kind of blight, and in this case, an environmental disaster. That's the what we're facing with climate change. Why don't they just move? But it's never so simple. Why don't you talk about some of the many, many options that they've been considering over the last 40 years, really?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the challenge. One, the town doesn't have a lot of resources, right? It's a small native community way out in Alaska. Most people in town, there aren't a whole lot of full-time jobs. They rely on subsistence hunting and fishing and berry gathering for food for a lot of the year. There's just not a whole lot of economic resources, which is really important when you need to move. So that's a big factor. The thing that held them up the most is trying to find a new location. You know, you have to find a place that you can go. And in Alaska, they had to find a place that is not going to be subject to the same problems that they're having here. And the village would really like to still be close to where they are now so they can still access their area where their, you know, their families and their ancestors have hunted and fished for a very long time. And so they want to go to the mainland, but they don't want to get too far away. But they've found a lot of trouble in finding a location that was really suitable. But I've also had just trouble getting money to even do the sort of studies that you need to find that location. They've had some support for research in the past, but it's also, you have to get experts up and you have to sort of have those evaluations, and that's sort of where they got hung up. They really couldn't get to the point where they found one place and then they found out that it wasn't going to work, and they haven't really gotten beyond that point. There hasn't really been a point agency for them to go to and even get advice about how you would make this happen. It's basically been left up to the village itself to try to figure out how to navigate both the state and federal bureaucracy and try to get the resources they need to make it happen.
Yes, I mean, the FEMA is an emergency agency, but it's not a proactive emergency agency, correct?
Right. I mean, they have some, FEMA does have a little bit of funding to do some proactive things, but for the most part, it's an agency that's designed to come in after emergency has happened and then help. And, FEMA has been involved after they've had some pretty big erosion events and some pretty big storms and have helped with, trying to rebuild things and help people after the events. But going forward, there's not really an agency that can be the, sort of lead agency on this at this point in time. The Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Department of Interior has helped them with some projects, and they've also had some funding through the Army Corps of Engineers to do some studies and to build part of the seawall that they have protecting a portion of the community right now. But that also, in order to have an Army Corps project, you have to have authorization from Congress and funding from Congress. So it's, they're a little tiny village that's trying to compete for resources within a giant bureaucracy here in the U.S., and it's a tough fight.
Talk about the adventure you had just getting there, and it didn't seem like the America that you grew up in, I'm imagining.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never been to Alaska before, so this is a totally new experience for me.
Just to interrupt real quickly, just as an aside, your intrepid host actually spent his first year of his life about 100 miles north of the town of Shishmaref.
Where?
I was an infant in Kotzebue.
So
it's just across the Kotzebue Sea from Shishmaref. I guess it's around equidistant from Nome, which is the other town. They're both around 3,000 cities, quote unquote cities of 3,000. Those are the big cities compared to the Shishmarefs of Alaska. But I don't.
Right.
So this is a story that's near and dear to my heart. Although I only have the pictures to prove that I was there, I don't remember it at all. I'm sorry. Go on.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, it is. It's a place that not a lot of people will get to, because you have to first you fly to Anchorage, and then you fly from Anchorage to Nome, and then you take another hour long flight from Nome to get to this little tiny island. It's only the only way.
Which has no roads, right?
The island has a portion of a paved road that goes to the airport, but it's pretty short. It's like I said, it's like 600 people. It's pretty isolated. They do get. They've had a lot of visitors through there because there was so much attention and reporters there after they voted to move. So they're pretty used to seeing reporters coming and asking them about their climate change problems.
But they don't have running water in most of the homes, and they go to the laundromat to take their showers and things like that. This is not an easy lifestyle.
No, not an easy lifestyle, absolutely. Most people use the washateria to wash their clothes and to take a shower. There isn't indoor plumbing in most houses, so they use a sort of system that involves buckets, and they take them to the sewage lagoon. I stayed at the elementary school when I was there because there's no hotels there. So I slept in the floor of the library, and the school is one of the only places that has running water and showers. So it was a pretty nice place to stay, but yeah, it's a tough life. And I was there in August, and August is beautiful and lovely in Alaska. I don't know that I'd want to be there in the middle of the winter. It's a rough life.
And yet the population, I was surprised to learn, is growing there.
Yeah, the Spokesman Townsend, it has been growing recently. There are a number of young people who have had children, and it has been growing recently. But
is that mostly just people not leaving? I don't assume that there's a lot of people moving to Shishmaref. It's just that they're procreating.
Right, people having children. Yeah. But at the same time, when the folks I talked to in the story, you're seeing people with means leaving. If you can find a job in Nome, or if you can find a job somewhere else, and Some people have elected to do that because it's become, you know, harder to live there, and they don't know what the long-term trajectory is. They, you know, if they can't relocate, they don't really know what will happen there. So one of the gentlemen I talked to when I was in the town is relocating for that reason.
Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92 with George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold below that old white mountain just a little southeast of Nome. Sam crossed the majestic mountain to the valleys far below. He topped his team of huskies as he mushed on through the snow. Where the northern lights are running wild in the land of the midnight sun. Yes, Sam McCord was a mighty man in the year of 91. Where the river is winding, big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, we go north, the rush is on.
Way up north, way up north.
North to Alaska, we go north, the rush is on.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Kate Shepard. She's a senior reporter and the environment and energy editor at the Huffington Post. So the town of Shishmaref is not unique. Why is this an important story? And why don't you give us a better idea of the lay of the land in Alaska? There are dozens, maybe hundreds of these type of communities that are looking to relocate because of climate change.
Yeah, so there are 12, at least 12 villages that have formally voted to relocate and started that process. Shishmaref is just one of them. But Kivalina, Newtok is another town that's also voted to relocate and is actually a little bit closer to relocating because they've been able to find a new location and been able to find some money, but they've been having a pretty big political fight over how it will happen. So they haven't actually moved yet either. But, you know, there's 12 villages that are actively seeking to move, and then you have around 200 native villages in Alaska that are seeing some kind of impacts related to erosion and climate change. So there are a lot of other places that are seeing this problem in Alaska. But I think the bigger story for me is that, you know, Alaska's seeing these impacts first because of, you know, where they are and because these villages are located in these pretty tough locations. But I think we'll see this in a lot of other parts of the U.S. as well. I grew up in New Jersey. There's parts along the Delaware shore there that have been dealing with sea level rise and erosion and destruction of homes as well. And I just think this is something that we're going to be facing all across the country going forward. And for me, it's really sort of this case study. If we can figure out how to help this town, maybe we can help everyone else. But if we can't figure out how to help this town, I don't really know what that says about our ability to really deal with this issue across the country going forward.
Because these people don't have a really strong voice in terms of representation and financial wherewithal, how do you see relocation efforts playing out in the mainland differently? Or do you think that the Shishmaref template is one that we're going to be looking toward?
I think that communities on the mainland that are dealing with similar issues probably will have somewhat of an easier time. They might be, you know, a place that is a little bit more easy for people in Washington to picture. It might be more populated. They probably have more economic resources, so that might make it a little bit easier for them. But I think what we've found with these villages in Alaska is that there's not really a clear game plan, right? Like, if the community needs to move, how do you make that decision? Who's in charge? Who moves first? How do you pay for it? You know, there are all these, like, really clear questions that need to be answered, and I think that's what sort of the biggest takeaway here is that we need to figure out what that system is, because every community can't be on its own and trying to figure it out, because it's just not practical or effective to do it that way.
And I guess the real question is whether they want to try to keep that community intact and move it to another location, build buildings and an infrastructure for those people who are living in that town, or do they want them to be more refugees where they scatter to the nearby towns that aren't in such dire economic and environmental straits?
Right, and you know, the people in Shishmaref have been very clear that they would like to stay together because they do have a unique culture and language and history, and it's a pretty tight community. It's small, so you know they rely on each other in a way that I think a lot of us in bigger communities probably don't understand. So they would like to keep that together and relocate together, but if they can't do that, they probably will end up being spread out.
So what's your sense after visiting the town, Kate? How lost in time or how isolated has Shishmaref been in terms of their culture and their language? Would these people be able to integrate into the Nomes and Kotzebues and neighboring cities?
Absolutely. I think they would be able to do that. It's mostly the elders who still speak Inupiaq, and the young people all, you know, go to school and watch TV, and a lot of them end up going to Nome to get healthcare, or they've gone to college in Fairbanks. I mean, so people, you know, a lot of people there have lived elsewhere and would probably be fine. But I think the question for them is, would their community be fine? Would they still have the sort of uniqueness that they prize about their community and about their where they live if they had to go somewhere else? And I think that's what they want to preserve.
You quoted a letter from Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski, who is complaining to the Obama administration that at the same time the administration is helping to fund Vietnam's climate adaptation plans, that towns like Shishmaref are being left to the wayside. Could you expand on the Obama administration's assistance to Vietnam?
Yeah, she was bringing up some specific pool of money, I guess, that had been allocated through a program. I'm not actually even entirely sure what exactly that funding pool that she was talking about was, but more broadly, the administration, through our engagement in the United Nations process to negotiate a new climate agreement, is, you know, taking part in the Green Climate Fund, which is a way for developed countries to provide funding to developing nations to deal with climate impacts and adaptation, and also to cut their own emissions going forward. And the U.S. just recently pledged $3 billion to that fund. And I think Murkowski's broader point is that the U.S. government funds sort of international climate work through various different development sources. And if we can spend that much money abroad, why can't we spend that much money here? And, you know, I think we can do both. I don't think it's an either or. I don't know that I would agree with that implication, but I do think she does, you know, isolate what I think is a tension between how much we engage with, you know, talking about this issue as something that's happening in other places, but not necessarily recognizing what's happening here and what needs to happen here now. It's funny, I was actually in Vietnam a few years ago doing a climate change story as well. And, you know, I've seen communities there that are dealing with the same issues too. So it's, you know, is it important to provide assistance for Vietnam as well? So it's not like they don't need that assistance.
The Army Corps of Engineers in 2004 estimated that relocating this village of 560 people to the Alaskan mainland would cost $179 million. That seemed very high to me. Is this what we're going to be looking at in terms of, I can't imagine what the cost could possibly be for a town in New Jersey with a population in the tens of thousands. So is that $179 million a reasonable number? It seemed very high to me.
I mean, I think you have to do quite a bit to move a town, right? Like, you have to build all new infrastructure. They're talking about, in this case, maybe, you know, making improvements in the new location so that they would have running water and have a health clinic, a school. I mean, if you start thinking about all the things that you need in a community, it does add up pretty quickly. But I think the point a lot of people in that town make is that, you know, if you look here and things we spend money on in the lower 48, the things that we appropriate through Congress, you know, 179 actually, in the grand scheme of things, isn't that much. And it probably makes more sense in the long term to do that than it does to keep investing in building new things in this town or building seawalls or improving their health clinic if it's probably, you know, not going to be possible for them to stay indefinitely. So might as well make a smart investment rather than a short-term one.
So you're going to be going back to Alaska anytime soon to keep covering pieces like this, Kate?
Oh, I hope so. It was a great experience, and I, I'd like to make it back up there again. It's sort of an endless source of stories up there as well. I have a couple. I did another one on Pebble Mine when I was up there, and then I have another one looking at some other mining work in the state that I'm going to be writing going forward. So,
and just recently there was an announcement from the Obama administration about a moratorium on new oil and gas exploration in which region of Alaska?
But last night, the Obama administration announced that they were barring oil and gas drilling in the Bristol Bay region.
Right. And what does that ultimately mean?
Well, it's going to keep this area off limits for development indefinitely. This area had been, they'd been going sort of back and forth on whether it would be leased for oil and gas development. It had been taken off of the lease sale plan after the Exxon Valdez spill. And then in 2007, the Bush administration decided that they were going to reopen that area for oil and gas drilling. And then 2010, President Obama took it off, at least through the 2017 lease sale. And so his announcement yesterday, they're going to make it off limits permanently, which I think a lot of people in the region are very excited about because Bristol Bay is an enormous fishery. It's where we get quite a bit of our salmon and halibut and crab. And people see it as a sort of really important resource for fishing that, you know, really isn't worth the risk of a potential spill there if you were to allow drilling to go forward.
Well, you're a great resource. The work you continue to do, I highly recommend our listeners read the entire piece on Huffington Post, Climate Change Takes a Village. Kate Shepard, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Everybody's building ships and boats. Some are building monuments. Some are jotting down notes.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm now joined on Sea Change Radio by a very special guest, Congressman Jack Kimble, representing California's 54th District. Congressman, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex. Good to be here.
The 54th District, I always thought California had 53, but maybe you can enlighten us a little bit more about the 54th.
Well, I think that's a problem a lot of people have with the census and the changing numbers. A lot of times people are confused.
So is this a gerrymandered district that just was created recently?
Actually, this is one of the oldest districts California has, both in terms of how old the district is and how old its residents are.
So, Congressman, you say that the EPA is one of the biggest causes of the recent recession and that the environmental red tape that it created got us into this mess. Can you explain a little bit more for our audience?
How do most people come to see pollution? In California, we do every now and then see things like smog, sure. But most people, they learn about pollution through reports. And who puts out those reports?
The liberal media.
The liberal media. And a lot of times, it's the EPA. If there's no EPA, there's no reports.
Then there's no pollution.
Then there's no pollution.
I see. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Representative Jack Kimble. People can follow him on Twitter at Rep Jack Kimble. He represents California's 54th district, which has yet to be discovered. Let's go through some of the positions that you and your party hold. Where do you stand in terms of tax breaks for oil and gas companies?
The problem with oil and gas right now, frankly, is it's too expensive. And if we can cut the taxes that oil and gas companies pay, they can pass the savings on to their consumers. I have a big problem with the whole regulation of oil right now. You know, it's illegal for the average American citizen to buy and refine his own gasoline. There's something about that American spirit of making your own gasoline, and I think we need to encourage that.
Especially in high-density urban populations, I can imagine.
It's something you can do out in the garage, really.
So what about climate change? Where do you stand on this? Do you believe in climate change, or is it more like a theory like evolution?
I'm kind of two minds about it. Yes, very much like evolution and gravity, I do think that it's still a theory. However, I'm starting to believe that there might be some truth to this, and I think we need to embrace it.
So what do we do?
Embrace it.
What kind of legislation on a more macroeconomic level do you foresee?
The first thing that we need to do as a country is invest in sand.
Sand?
Sand.
Sand is pretty cheap, isn't it?
Exactly. Right now it is. It's going to get more expensive.
So you think this is a great time to get in on the bottom with sand?
We get in on the bottom. And you look at a state like Minnesota. Minnesota is known as the state of 10,000 lakes.
Probably a lot of sand next to those lakes, I imagine.
Well, that's the thing. If we put the sand next to the lakes with global warming, Minnesota could be the land of 10,000 tropical beaches. Think what that could do for tourism in this country.
So you see, you view climate change as an entrepreneurial opportunity.
I see a lot of beachfront property being created.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with the inimitable Representative Jack Kimball from California's 54th District. You write in your book, Profiles in Courageousness, Representative, that you're not in favor of legalized sex with a woman who's not ovulating. Is that right?
Right.
So are you in favor of having sex with your wife if she's not ovulating?
First off, I'm Catholic, and we believe that life begins at ejaculation. So I think that sex really should exist only for procreation. I went to Catholic school, and we were brought up on the three books.
What were the three books?
The Old Testament, the New Testament, and Atlas Shrugged.
So, Congressman, you had mentioned how we need to give more tax breaks to oil and gas companies. Let's talk about alternative energy for a second, like solar, wind. Are there any alternative energy sources that you support?
I support the major forms of alternative energy, gas and oil, of course. I think there's a lot that we could do with them that we're not doing right now.
Wait, excuse me. Gas and oil are alternative energy sources? I thought they were pretty much our main energy sources.
No. For home heating, for running an automobile, gas and oil are obviously our main energy sources. But for like running a calculator, many of those are solar powered now. I've actually was able to hook my solar powered calculator up to a gas engine that I got off my lawnmower, and it works perfectly even in dark.
So technically those all are alternative energy sources if they're being used by batteries or solar power and wind. You're saying alternatives to the alternatives are oil and gas.
Correct.
We've had a lot of guests on this show talking about alternative energy, but nobody had actually mentioned oil and gas as an alternative to alternatives.
I think gas-powered calculators probably could be the future in our schools.
You don't see that being cumbersome?
They are bulky, but they get 43 or 50 problems to the gallon.
And there could be more tie-in with oil and gas support of education, like you could have calculators by Chevron or Shell.
Oh, gosh. Exxon is doing so much for education already.
For example?
Their commercials right now to let us know how horrible American schools are wonderful.
And how is that helping American education?
Well, it's helping to shame teachers. And when teachers are a little bit timid, a little bit shy, feeling a little bad about themselves, that's when you can argue for less homework.
Representative Jack Kimball, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio.
Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Freddie Hubbard, Boxcar Willie, and the Grateful Dead. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.